from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll chat with Storytelling Arts' Ellen Munns about their new Life Stories project.
I'll chat with theater organist Mark Herman about his upcoming concert.
And I'll preview what the Hoosier Bard Theater Company is up to this spring. Plus, there'll be our Arts Counter events we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Everyone loves a good story, especially Ellen Munns, the longtime executive director of Storytelling Arts of Indiana. Travis DiNicola spoke with Munns about what stories are being told this spring, including their new Life Stories project.
Ellen, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always great to see you.
It's good to see you too, Travis.
Thanks. So what stories are we telling these days? You've got a lot of new stuff coming up this spring.
We do. I'm really excited about a new project that we are... kicking off in the next couple of months. It's called the Life Stories Project.
Okay. What is that? I mean, I have an idea when I hear the phrase Life Stories, but...
Well, we are actually going to go out into the community and collect stories from everyday people.
Okay.
Non-professional storytellers. And we're going to record them, edit them, and then put them on a website, lifestoriesproject.net.
Okay.
So that everyone and anyone can go online and they'll see a photograph of the person telling the story and then their story.
Neat.
And then the original recordings will be archived at the Oral History Collection at the Indiana Historical Society.
Very cool. Okay, so now these aren't necessarily interviews, though. They are non-storytellers, but telling some story from their life.
From their life. It could be about their favorite teacher. It could be about their favorite place they went on a vacation as a child. It could be about a picnic. It could really be about anything. And on the website, we will have prompts to help people think about what story they want to tell, and also some helpful hints on how to tell a story.
So, will the people doing the recording also be helping out with that?
Yes.
To sort of, you know, help people craft their story in the best way possible?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm really excited about it. And I think the first group we're going to work with is in May, probably with Freetown Village. Ophelia has some elderly people in mind that she would like to get their stories recorded. And the people who will be doing the recording and the interviews, we're going to use volunteers.
Okay.
And we have two volunteer dates for workshops for them. Tuesday, April 16th from 6 to 9 p.m. and then Saturday, April 27th from 9 a.m. till noon.
Great. And so people can get more information from Storytelling Arts website if they want to sign up to volunteer.
At this point, they probably need to just contact me, Ellen, at storytellingarts.org.
Okay. If they want to sign up for one of those orientations.
Yes. And it will be on the website. And they'll be able to send me an email.
So what's an example of one of those prompts or questions or things to think about to help someone, you know, really think about how they want to tell their story?
How about a time you got in trouble as a child?
Oh, I just thought of one right there. Okay.
Yeah, one just popped into my mind, too.
Okay.
You know, my family, we always went to the Outer Banks of North Carolina for vacation. And so that place has... a really, it just draws me as an adult.
Sure.
So, like, I could maybe tell a story about going there for vacation. You could tell a story about a house that you remember that had a lot of importance to you. One good way to remember stories is to think about your childhood home and start at the front door and walk in
and go
into all the different rooms of the house, and different memories will occur.
Neat.
Yeah, so it should be really fun.
I'm still thinking about getting in trouble as a child, but that's a whole other thing.
But I want to mention that WFYI and the Indiana Historical Society, they're co-partners in this project.
Very good. Yeah. Very good. Cool. That sounds like a great project.
I'm very excited about it. And if any of the stories are really good, they'll be aired on WFYI.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and that's so that'll be coming up later in the spring. Mm-hmm. In the more immediate future, I know that you have a lot of Jabberwockies going on. It's your monthly storytelling event that's in partnership with Indie Fringe. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, Jabberwocky is another example of where we gather just everyday people and get them to share their stories. So each month, it's the second Tuesday of the month, we have a theme and we find like four guest tellers to come in and tell stories on that theme. In March, the theme will be, March 12th, the theme will be Pushing Boundaries.
Okay.
And last month we did New Year's resolutions, and I had Brenda Myers from the Hamilton County Visitor and Bureau. She came and told her story of losing 45 pounds, I think, and how she did it.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else talked about Andrea Davis from the IBJ. She told her story of deciding that she was going to walk a 5K every month last year, which she did. They all, and someone else talked about how they don't make New Year's resolutions.
You've had a lot of fun themes in the past, I know, with Jabberwock. I mean, everything from summer camps to why people volunteer. Really neat themes.
Tattooing.
Tattooing.
Birthing stories.
And what's great about this is so you have invited storytellers that come in who aren't really professional storytellers, but invited guests who come in and share their stories. And then there's also open time at the end for anyone in the audience to share.
Right. An open mic where we ask people to share stories on the same theme.
Mm-hmm.
And we serve free appetizers. It's free to come. The cash bar. And it's right after work. The doors open like at 5:30, and it begins at 6.
And you always do this at the Indie Fringe Theater building, which is just off of Mass Ave.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Indie Fringe Basile Theater.
The Indie Fringe Basile Theater. Thank you very much.
And Jabberwocky is produced in collaboration with Indie Fringe. And if you're interested in seeing what the stories are like, you can go to YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
We have a channel, Storytelling Arts, and there's a whole selection of the stories from past times.
Oh, that's great. But that's a lot of fun. I didn't know that that you had a YouTube channel, Ellen.
Yes.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Now, I know you've got something coming on this weekend, this Saturday.
Yes. Willie Claflin from the San Francisco area.
Mm-hmm.
He will be telling a story titled Mrs. Satan for President.
That's a great title.
It is actually about his great-great aunt, who Victoria Woodhull, who actually ran for president in 1872 before women had the right to vote.
Huh.
She was also a woman's suffrage, women's rights, sexual freedom. So she's a real character. So he will be telling that story. It takes place Saturday night at the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana History Center. You can buy tickets online at our website, storytellingarts.org. Tickets are $20 in advance or $25 at the door.
Okay. And so there are will be some tickets available at the door.
Yes.
And again, that's at the History Center on Saturday night.
Yes, beginning at 7:30 p.m.
What else do you have going on? I know that, I mean, it always seems like you guys have so many different activities. You're bringing in storytellers from out of town. You have Jabberwocky. You have other things going on. I mean, Storytelling Arts really has grown a lot over the past couple of years, it seems. And more than just the annual Storytelling Festival. I mean, it's really things throughout the entire year.
Right. We actually don't do the festival anymore.
I was wondering. I didn't think so, but I wasn't sure if it was on hiatus or how that worked.
No,
but
we actually...
But that's how a lot of people first got to know you.
Yes.
And, you know, every fall you do the Storytelling Festival.
Yes. Well, one of the newer projects that we have going on is called If These Walls Could Tell, mm-hmm. and it's in collaboration with Indiana Landmarks.
Okay.
And it's funded by Frank and Katrina Basile. And what we do each year, Indiana Landmarks gives out the Cook Cup Award. Mm-hmm. And it is given to a building in Indiana for the best quality of restoration of that year.
Okay.
And so at that point, we commission a storyteller to go and research about the building and to put together an hour-long story about the building. But, you know, it becomes about the people in the building.
Sure.
The people who use the building during its history. So the first building we did was the Indiana Landmark Center. Last year, we did the Charlie Creek Inn in Wabash, Indiana. And this year, we're doing the Lerner Theater in Elkhart.
Okay.
So the story will be premiered here at Indiana Landmark Center in late March on the 22nd. But then later on this year, we will take it to the Lerner Theater, and it will be told there.
I was wondering if it would be told at the theater where the story is about. That's great. Mm-hmm. One thing that really strikes me, Ellen, is in hearing about all these different projects, you've mentioned so many different partners, whether it be Historic Landmarks or Fringe Theater or the History Center or WFYI. I mean, it really sounds like, I mean, Storytelling Arts is really partnering with other arts and cultural organizations and historical organizations.
We actually have a policy that we won't develop a new program unless we have collaborators and partners.
That's great.
So it seems kind of silly to go out and try to do something by yourself when there's so many other great organizations in the city to work with. Mm-hmm. And we, of course, we have...
And who have great spaces to perform in and host.
And our partnerships are more than just like getting the space for free. Like with Indiana Historical Society, they co-produce our entire season. We get some reduced rates with the theater, but they also help us with marketing. They... help us with bringing in school children to our show. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's really a true partnership.
Sure.
So it's really exciting to work with all these other organizations.
That's really great. And it's also really fascinating, though, that you have that policy now of, you know, only doing new projects in collaboration with other organizations. Mm-hmm. Your website for people to see a list of all the things that are coming up?
It's www.storytellingarts.org.
Very good.
And the website for the Life Stories Project, it's going to have its own website.
Okay.
It's www.lifestoriesproject.net.
And again, for that Life Stories Project, you'll be doing training of volunteers in April?
Yes, two different dates in April. One's during the week and one's on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
The dates are Tuesday, April 16th, and Saturday, April 27th.
And for people who want to record a story of their life, how do they sign up for that?
Well, eventually what will happen on the website, you will be able to go and see the different locations and the different times, and you'll be able to register online.
Great. Very good. Yes. Ellen, thanks so much for coming in today. Always great to hear from you.
Thank you so much, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with Ellen Munns, the Executive Director of Storytelling Arts of Indiana. To find out more, visit storytellingarts.org, storytellingarts.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Indianapolis musician Mark Herman was recently the youngest person ever to be named Theater Organist of the Year. The Fort Wayne native, who has traveled the world concertizing, will show off his skills in a concert at 2:30 on Sunday, March 3rd, on the Barton organ at the Warren Performing Arts Center. Mark dropped in to tell Sharon Gamble why he was smitten by the organ and how he decided to feature tunes from the great movie musicals in this upcoming concert.
Okay, no pressure or anything, but you are the youngest person ever to have been named Theater Organist of the Year. How does one get that sort of acclaim?
I suppose it comes from playing a lot of concerts and having a lot of people hear me and decide that I was good enough to be lumped into that bunch, which is a huge honor looking at the rest of the list.
And you are 20?
25.
Five. And you've been playing organ for more than half your life, is that right?
Since I was seven.
Most of your life. How did you get started?
Well, I played piano starting when I was, I have pictures of me at 2 years old sitting at a keyboard and punching around. I'm not sure when it became musical, but I started just playing by ear and then heard an organ when I was five at a cousin's wedding. And my uncle took me up to the organ loft or the balcony at this church and saw the great big pipe organ. And I saw all the keys, all of the buttons, and heard that big sound and decided, well, it's more complicated than the piano, lots more keys, it must be more fun, too.
Interesting logic, how little people's brains work. So who in your family was musical? Obviously, you had a piano in the home. Who played?
Well, the piano we had at home came with the house, actually. It was an old upright player piano that was in the basement, and I would love to go downstairs and play it, and before I could operate it myself, my dad would, you know, play a roll on it, and he had to pump it to provide the air and suction to make the whole thing work. It worked on vacuum. So I heard music of the 1920s and 30s through these piano rolls. And also, my grandmother played piano in the Murphy's Five and Dime store in downtown Fort Wayne. So she played all of those 1920s and 30s songs, and I took an interest in that immediately.
It's so and you grew up in Fort Wayne. It's so fascinating to think of a time when you could go shopping and hear a professional musician playing. I mean, it's just so crazy. And we think of I've just forgotten the name, the big department store in Philadelphia that had the amazing organ.
The Wanamaker store.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, people who grow up in Indianapolis may remember going to Ellis Ayers and hearing pianists play there, or even vocalists sing in the tea room. And it's just a bygone era these days.
Well, pianos used to be in almost every single house in America, really, especially in the 1920s before people owned radios or record players even. Everyone would have a piano, so if you went to buy a piece of sheet music to play of the popular music of the day, you might want to hear what it sounds like first. So they had someone sitting there, you could just sit the music in front of them, and they would play it, and you could decide whether you'd like to buy it or not.
Pre-portable iPod, the piano in every
right.
home. So you moved on and you said, although I have to say the fact that you were dealing with a player piano first kind of prepared you for dealing with instruments that might be a little more temperamental. So you kind of had a head start for the complications of an organ. And at some point you started being driven to Indianapolis from Fort Wayne for weekly lessons. How did that happen?
Right. Well, I started piano lessons when I was seven, and organ lessons about a year or two after that. However, that was church organ, and we all know what a church organ sounds like. They're wonderful instruments, but they don't particularly lend themselves well to swing music and jazz music that I was also interested in. So I discovered an organ at the Embassy Theater in Fort Wayne that was a theater organ. These instruments were designed in the 1920s to provide accompaniment to the silent movies. And as such, they needed to be very orchestral in nature. They needed to be able to play marches and, popular songs.
They needed to have rhythm and brass and...
Yeah, they're called the unit orchestra because there are strings, there's clarinets, there are flutes, trumpets. There are actual drums, cymbals, xylophones, marimbas, things like that in the organs that operate via air pneumatics that hit the stuff and make the sound just like in a symphony orchestra.
I'm understanding why one of your albums is titled Kid in a Candy Store. I'm watching your face as you describe
all the inner workings.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's funny that people often think of piano and organ in the same breath because they both have keyboards, but in some ways they're not very similar. Were there any piano habits that you had to unlearn when you started taking organ as well?
No, in fact, quite the opposite. I think that a good piano background is invaluable to an organist, because I think you really build a lot of your technique just playing scales and things like that, hand and exercises on the piano. And my organ teacher down here in Indianapolis insisted that I get together with a good piano teacher at the local university in Fort Wayne, which was the best thing I ever did. Someone who was perhaps more serious than a music store piano teacher. And we really started approaching classical repertoire and building my technique. But getting back to your earlier question, I started coming down to Indianapolis when I was 13. The finest theater organ teacher in the country and probably the world was down here, John Ferguson, who moved to Indianapolis to help open the Paramount Music Palace on the east side. He was the musical director there and designed the theater organ that was installed over there at that pizza restaurant for many years. He was a phenomenal teacher, and more phenomenal were my parents for being willing to drive their 13-year-old son down to Indianapolis every single week. They would take turns. Sometimes they do it together. And as soon as I got my license at 16, they turned the keys over to me pretty quickly to do the trip on my own.
That's commitment, both on your part and your parents' part, too. But they clearly saw something they wanted to nurture in you.
Right. And John Ferguson was a little skeptical at first, but some others finally convinced him to hear me play. And what was kind of an audition almost to see if he wanted to take me on as a student really became our first lesson, because we worked together very well instantly. And although I'm sure he pulled a few hairs out at times teaching me, we still remain good friends to this day.
I'd say that your being named Theater Organist of the Year probably helped vindicate any doubts that he had, right? So, you know, you're doing a concert on March 3rd at the Warren Performing Arts Center, and I want to know about that organ that's people touring through here are often secured to play that organ, which means it's a worthy instrument. Tell me about it.
Well, it's a really phenomenal organ. It's owned by the Central Indiana chapter of the American Theater Organ Society, which is a group I'm also a part of living here in Indianapolis. It originally was built for the Indiana Theater downtown, which, of course, has been largely gutted and transformed and chopped up into smaller places to become the Indiana Repertory Theater. But that, of course, was a 3,000-plus seat theater at one time, a really, really gorgeous auditorium. And this organ was installed there and specified by their organist at the time, who was Dessa Bird, who was pretty well known here in Indianapolis.
I bet more than a few dozen listeners have a Dessa Bird album in their collection, including myself.
So when the theater was going to be transformed, the organ went to, I believe it was the Indiana Historical Society, because it was going to be installed in their new building when that happened.
Really?
And that never did happen. So arrangements were made, and the organ was acquired by the Central Indiana chapter of the American Theater Organ Society, who, with a couple of its members, had arranged to get organ chambers included in the design of the new Warren Performing Arts Center, which is part of the Warren High School complex. It's a beautiful auditorium. I think it's about 1,200 seats, absolutely fabulous acoustics, wonderful for the organ. And it's really like it was built for the building. It's a sensational sound in there. And I bet it probably never sounded so good even in the Indiana Theater.
That's pretty exciting then that you have a chance to play it. And you've been kind of noodling around, and you mentioned before we turned the computer on that you had come up with a theme for your concert, which is?
Right. It's a tribute to the golden age of movie musicals. Everything ranging from the Busby Berkeley musicals of the 1930s through 1960s musicals like My Fair Lady and The Music Man, a pretty wide spectrum of songs, but it's all the music that I really love.
Now, I don't know how common this is among organists, and you're a pretty modest guy, but you do some arranging, you roll your sleeves up and get into the voicing of organs and the repair of organs. Is that common?
As far as real pipe organs, you know, my knowledge is and experience isn't particularly extensive. You know, I've tuned organs and know how they work and helped work on them. What I've really gotten involved in recently is the voicing and tonal finishing of digital organs. I'm associated with the Allen Organ Company, which is the largest builder of organs, and they make digital instruments for churches and homes, concert halls, things like that. And they require extensive tonal finishing and note-by-note voicing to make them come together and sound, you know, just like a pipe organ would in a room.
And it's very specific to that room that it's in, so you have to have exquisitely tuned ears to be able to do that.
Yeah, any organ will sound completely different in whatever room you put it in. And depending on how the speakers are arranged, you know, one tiny adjustment with a speaker can make a huge difference.
What's your, do you have a favorite organ? You have a favorite instrument in the world or one that you have read about and you're just desperate to play, but you haven't been invited to play it yet?
Oh, gosh, I have several. I think right off the top of my head, one of my favorite instruments is installed in the Castro Theater in San Francisco, a gorgeous theater from, I think it's either the late teens or early 20s it was built. And a friend of mine out in California was associated with that organ. A couple of friends, actually. Ed Stout and Dick Taylor are a couple of the finest organ men in the country as far as working on these things, specifically theater organs. And that's one of their magnum opuses.
Hmm. So that goes on the bucket list.
Indeed. But, you know, we're very fortunate here in Indiana to have some absolutely fantastic instruments, the one in Warren Performing Arts Center being one of them. But also the Embassy Theater in Fort Wayne has a sensational four-manual, four-keyboard theater organ. And that's the one that first really got me excited about it. And also now down at the Circle Theater downtown, there's a wonderful new installation by Carlton Smith, who we're lucky to have here locally, actually only a few blocks away from us.
Sharon Gamble with organist Mark Herman. Find out more about Mark and his March 3rd concert at the Warren Performing Arts Center at markhermanproductions.com. Again, markhermanproductions.com. And here's a sample of Mark's playing from his album, A Kid in the Candy Store. Well, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to you and all our listeners. We love all of you.
We do.
And you're soon to be our viewers.
That's true. That's coming next week.
It's coming next week.
If you don't know
what
we're talking about, well, you haven't been paying attention.
That's
but,
right.
but anyway, if you are listening, of course, on Thursday, then happy Valentine's. If you're listening on Saturday morning, well, good morning, and I hope you had a happy Valentine's.
That's right.
And yeah, next week we premiere Art of the Matter on TV on WFYI on Channel 20,
yeah,
WFYI
1. That's the one with the picture.
It's the one with the picture. So we get to see what each other looked like.
Something like that. Can we see our viewers?
I don't know. They can see us. That's how it works. It only goes one way so far. It's this whole new thing they have called TV, Sharon.
I love that.
Not quite like radio.
Okay.
We're still learning. Anyway, so that'll be next week. But right now, we've still got that calendar on radio that we call.
What will we do? I think it'll still be called that on TV.
7:30, right, on Tuesdays? Is that when we're going to be on?
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly right.
We're just taking over the universe.
I'm not sure where billboards are next. I don't know.
No, fun.
Your iPod.
Eventually
is
bobbleheads. So, what do you got for our calendar?
I have a couple of fun things coming up at the Prop a Lamb. There is something called the Ultimate in Antiquing, and what it is a three-course dinner to which you can bring an antique piece, object, small piece of furniture,
as a date?
You name it.
No?
Wow. Okay. It depends on how old you are, I suppose. I think you're bringing your date.
Your date
your
and
spouse,
a, an
your
antique.
Sweetheart probably should pick one of those, not both of them, and an antique item.
Okay.
And there's an instant appraisal available. There'll be an appraiser there. When is this taking place? March 6th and the 24th from 7 to 10. It's $38. Here's the reason you want to take a date. $38 per person or $60 per couple. I'll help you do the math.
There you go.
It's cheaper if you have a date. Cheaper
now,
per person.
Will they also give you an instant appraisal of your date, too?
I don't know, but I'm sure you can find out more if you go to thepropylaeum.org. PROPYLAEUM.
No, that sounds very cool. I mean, so you can, if you've got an interesting antique piece at home, bring it in and get it appraised there. Or bring your date.
I'm so sorry, you dear people at the Propylaeum.
Oh, happy Valentine's. Hey, if you're still looking for a great idea for Valentine's, it's not too late.
8 o'clock on Thursday night?
Well,
okay.
This event doesn't take place until Saturday, February 23rd.
Got
it's the Adult Swim at the Children's Museum. So you still could buy your tickets now and give it to your sweetie and say, oh, I was planning this forever, of course. What is the Adult Swim? Well, it is an adults-only night at the Children's Museum, where they are turning the Children's Museum into a five-story casual chic cocktail lounge with music and dancing and drinks and games and DJs and much, much more. It should be a ton of fun. You get to experience the Children's Museum as an adult with your cocktails and no kids. And it is all being organized by the Sapphire Theater Company. And you can get more information at AdultSwimIndy.com. Again, AdultSwimIndy.com. What are you laughing about?
Don't put your martini down in the dinosaur bone dig, please.
Oh, they're going to have a lot of people, I bet, like cleaning up the cocktails afterwards when they reopen for the kids. That's a whole other thing. But
I don't know. Maybe the kids should learn about grown-up life. it is an educational institution after all.
Well, we'll be back next week with more ideas of what to do to make up. We don't make them up. Never mind. Anyway, on that calendar we call What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Each spring for the past few years, IUPUI's Hoosier Bard Project has produced a Shakespeare play with a unique twist, and this spring is no different. They'll be performing two different versions of Measure for Measure over two weekends at the Indie Fringe Theater. Travis DiNicola spoke with Associate Professor of English Drama Terry Burris and Shakespeare scholar Gary Taylor to find out more.
Terry, Gary, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always great to see you both.
Hi, Travis.
Great to see you.
Thank you. So, Measure for Measure, before we get into talking about your production, I'm trying to think. I don't know that I've actually seen a production of this. I know a bit of the story. I know that it's sometimes, usually, classified as a comedy, but that's kind of questionable sometimes. It's a weird story, though. I mean, isn't
it a great
bit?
Story?
Tell me a bit about this story.
It's a sexy story.
It's a sexy story.
There is a lot of sex. I mean, and some mistaken identities and all those things.
But that's also part of the reason it's less familiar.
Yeah.
The play, for several centuries, was not performed because the story was considered too scandalous.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't until the 1960s that it became possible to perform the play. And since then, it's actually, if you look at, you know, global figures, it's one of the most popular of Shakespeare's plays in the theater around the world in the last 50 years or so.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because
sex sells.
Well, it's not just sex. It's the relationship between sex and the law, and the relationship between sex and politics, and issues of religious hypocrisy and sex and power. So, those are the subjects that I think make it very powerfully interesting in the modern world, and it's also a in some ways, a story that is a debate between liberal and conservative ideas about whether you should regulate people's sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So, and those are issues that have become very divisive in our society.
And the plot really does revolve around this concept that if a couple's not married and they're together, then the man can be put to death, right? I mean, basically.
Yes, it imagines a situation in which sex outside of marriage is not just a felony but a capital offense.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the context of contemporary debates about, you know, birth control, not just abortion but birth control, and sexuality outside of marriage, but also sexuality that isn't about necessarily reproduction, but sexuality for pleasure, all of these issues, which were very real in Shakespeare's time and are still very real now, but there were centuries in which we just didn't talk about those things in public.
Now, was there ever a law in the books, I mean, during Shakespeare's time, that if a couple was having sex out of wedlock, that it was a capital offense? Or do we know if there was ever a law like that, or was it more just sort of you play around with that? Terry?
That was after Shakespeare's time.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
But there was a social censure on it. Shakespeare, as you might know, married his wife, Anne Hathaway, when she was a little over 3 months pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And the church in Stratford-upon-Avon could have punished them by forcing them to come to church wrapped in white sheets. I don't know why white sheets, but they had to wrap themselves in white sheets and proclaim their sin to the congregation. As it was, Shakespeare's father, or maybe it was Anne Hathaway's father, got them quickly into the next the neighboring parish and had what later became known as a shotgun wedding.
Right.
but they were there was a kind of shaming ritual.
Sure.
To premarital sex.
Mm-hmm.
It was discouraged, of course, because legitimacy was of paramount importance, and you see this issue coming up in Shakespeare's plays over and over again. Legitimacy, inheritance, the legal issue, if you look at Lear, for example, mm-hmm. with Edmund and Edgar, but not just Lear. It's a theme that repeats itself over and over in Shakespeare's plays.
Now, I will say that this does not sound like the makings of a comedy, necessarily.
But, well, I also want to say that, during the Puritan Revolution, after Shakespeare's death, adultery was made a capital offense. And one of the things that this play is partly about is the rise of that element of English society, which had a much, much stricter sense of morality than had been prevalent in the 16th century.
Okay.
Yeah, lots more fun in the Elizabethan age than under James or Charles I or Oliver Cromwell.
Well, but there are, and this is where we get to the two versions of the play.
Right.
Because the earlier version of the play is much more Elizabethan, and, you know, sex is the subject of comedy. And there are obstacles that stand in the way of the final resolution, as there are in all of Shakespeare's comedies. I mean, in almost all comedy still. But you have a sense that it's all going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
After all, in the Comedy of Errors, you know, there's a threat of death going to be imposed on somebody in the very first scene of the play.
Sure.
So that's sort of par for the course for Shakespeare, that the stakes are high.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the satisfaction of the comic ending is the sense of difficulties overcome. But then when, you know, almost 20 years later, the play gets revived and adapted, it's a very different social atmosphere, and the writer who adapted it, Thomas Middleton, has a very different take on the problems that this play raises. So the logic of presenting these two versions is that people have often been confused about where is this play going, because you get kind of mixed signals, and
sure.
the reason is that people have been combining two different versions of the play.
Okay.
And so that the Shakespearean version is more like other Shakespeare comedies set in Italy. You know, Italy is where people go on vacation, and usually they go on vacation for certain kinds of fun that isn't necessarily have anything to do with marriage. And that's an image of Italy that, you know, exists.
It certainly seems like when you go to Italy, there's a lot of confusion of identity, too, that
yes,
always
exactly.
seems to show up.
Yes, yes, you have confusions of identity.
Including
confusions of identity in the bedroom.
You're right, right. I mean, that's which is a big part of Measure for Measure. So let me ask you this. Who was Thomas Middleton?
Thomas Middleton is our other Shakespeare. Thomas Middleton is a great playwright from Shakespeare's time. He was a younger contemporary of Shakespeare's. They collaborated. But then after Shakespeare's death, Middleton was the only playwright of the time who was asked by Shakespeare's own theater company to adapt his work after his death. And so Measure for Measure is one of those. Middleton is a much more realistic and modern playwright than Shakespeare. Some people would say he's more cynical. Certainly, he's more interested in the darker side of human behavior, and very interested in illegitimate sex.
Mm-hmm.
But also very interested in religious and political issues, and
so
much
when
more
you say
much
adapt,
more skeptical, much more skeptical about the people in charge.
Okay, he was essentially being asked by Shakespeare's theater to update it
to update it.
Okay,
I mean, and this is the beginning of a process that continues up to the present. I mean, Shakespeare's plays have been adapted more often than they have been revived in their original state.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes on all the time. It goes on in films now and graphic novels
sure.
and everything else. So that's the beginning of the process, that this was an old play, and they wanted to keep the Shakespeare name and to keep things in the play that were good. But they also wanted to make it seem new and relevant to present tense audiences.
Now, which is the one that most audiences today would have seen?
The Middleton version, the one that was adapted afterwards. Yeah,
okay. Middleton version.
And I think we should note that Middleton worked with Shakespeare, or adapted another play, Macbeth, and it's Middleton who created the tone of the Macbeth that we see now. And as he did with this Measure for Measure, the second weekend that we stage, the second weekend is the Middleton version.
So the first weekend will be the original Shakespeare, second weekend Middleton.
Right. Okay. So the original is Shakespeare set in Italy, set in the summertime, Shakespearean verse and comedy. The second weekend is set in Vienna, Austria, in the wintertime.
But also in wartime.
And in war, at peace as opposed to wartime. So it's quite a different tone. But the same actors are playing the same roles.
That's got to be fun for them. Or challenging, confusing, I'm
just
sure.
Keep them all healthy.
well, it's both fun and challenging because one of the things that happens to actors always in rehearsal is that you start out with all sorts of possibilities for interpretation of the character. By the end of rehearsal, you have to choose one set of interpretations and stick to it.
Well, but you're having them choose two and try to stick to it on the right night.
This way, they actually get to explore two different ways of playing the same character.
Yeah.
And the characters are not, I mean, there are places where Middleton has added material. There's other places where he seems to have cut material. So there are changes in the text of the two versions. But those changes and the change in location, but also the change in the circumstances of production, mean that you can have exactly the same words sometimes, but they mean something else. They have a different tone to them. So because in 1603, peace had just broken out in England, and there was a new king, and England was at peace for the first time in decades. But in 1621, when Middleton adapted it after Shakespeare's death, not only England but Europe was in the first few years of what became the 30 Years' War.
It's a very, very different feel.
Very different, you know, audiences came to the two versions of the play in a very different space, and so did the actors.
Mm-hmm. Terry, this must be, though, quite a challenge for you as a director as well.
Yes, it's been very, it was an exciting idea that has...
now you're starting to wonder about?
No. Actually, no, it's been wonderful to watch the actors work on the two different versions because basically they're doing two scripts in rep. They're doing this back-to-back, so it's very Shakespearean in that sense, very early modern, I should say. And they are enjoying playing their characters in different ways. For example, Angelo, who is the character who is the a duke, passes a law that there will be no premarital sex, and he gives the enforcement of this law to Angelo. And in the Austrian version, he's very cold. Very judgmental, and he's righteous. But in the Italian version, he's really the odd man out in Italy. And so he's managed to find this actor. It's been such a wonderful journey to watch him find the funny places, the places where he can let down his hair a little bit with the Italian version.
Do you, when you rehearse this, I'm curious, do you alternate evenings? Like tonight we're going to rehearse the Shakespeare version, tomorrow night's Middleton, and then go back and forth? Or do you try to do both on the same night ever? Or how does that work for you?
I decided actually that what we would do is we would work on the Middleton version first. That's the longer version, the darker version, really the more difficult version, I think, in interpretation and in setting. There are a lot, and also the music needed to be in that. So I thought if we did the version, the Austrian version first, the Middleton version first, it would almost be easy to slip into the Italian version.
So then after you're complete with that, to go back to Italian,
Right. Okay. So we did, we rehearsed the Middleton version for 3 weeks, and did full runs, and then we switched over to the Ferrara or Shakespearean version, and we are just now in runs for the Italian version. And we'll be, but then we'll ricochet.
Then you
got to
go back and
we'll
and rediscover the Austrian version, right?
Yes, yes. After we do, we'll run right up into production with Shakespeare.
Wow.
And then the day after that production closes on the 23rd, on the 24th, we'll be back in Austria. And into our German. Mm-hmm. I don't want to mix Austria up with German, but we tend to do that when we're talking about it. But it is set in Vienna, and the Viennese version, we'll move from summer, flowery wine, lovely Italy into very cold, mountainous Austria. Yes. So we'll see.
Oh, this sounds like it'll be a lot of fun, especially to be able to see both versions one week and then the next.
Yeah, and different costuming, of course, which makes a lot of difference to the actors to be in different costumes, but also to the audience.
Very good. Terry, Gary, thank you so much for coming in Art of the Matter today. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Travis.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with IUPUI, New Oxford Shakespeare Project, Associate Professor of English Drama, Terry Burris, and Shakespeare Scholar, Gary Taylor. The Hoosier Bard production of Measure for Measure will take place from February 21st through March 2nd at the Indie Fringe Theater. For ticket information, visit IndieFringe.org. IndieFringe.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I'll get a preview of the annual Woodcarvers exhibit at Eagle Creek.
I'll chat with jazz singer Toni Deckers about her music.
And I'll find out about a public art contest being organized by the Da Vinci Project Group. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.